Hi, this is Terry Cozman from Penn State University, and I'd like to do a presentation today on microfluidics. The topic is microfluidics, a review with some selected biological applications. So here's the outline of today's talk. What we're going to do is we're going to look at the overview of microfluidics, and basically in this section, we're going to point out why are microfluidics important, and why are they important in nanotechnology, and why would you want to learn it? It's actually an intriguing topic and a personal topic that I look at and do research in. The second topic here is going to be the physics of microfluidics. So really there's some unexpected and unusual, maybe unexpected physics that you weren't aware of, that microfluidics operates in a different world. So we're going to have to review some of the constraints for microfluidics compared to the macro world. And then what we're going to do is we'll take a look at the operational components that would make up a microfluidic device. So we would commonly look at issues like how to mix fluids and maybe valves and things like that. And then at the end of the presentation, we'll take a look at the materials that are commonly used in microfluidics and how we would manipulate those materials, and then some applications for microfluidics. So here, starting our overview, microfluidics is the science of designing, manufacturing, and formulating devices and processes that handle volumes of fluid in the order of nano or picoliters. And if we look down the bottom here, this is important that, 30 nanoliters, which is 1/1000th of a droplet, is actually viable to do work in. So that means that we don't need that a large amount of material to work with, which is certainly efficient. And one of the impacts of microfluidics, since we're only using this amount, that's the amount that we would have to get rid of. So, for example, if we were studying some kind of serum that might have like Ebola in it or HIV or something like that, we really don't want to have vast amounts of that to dispose of because that's quite expensive. So if we have small amounts of this material that we're analyzing, the cost to dispose of the material would be a lot less. And then this is a nice drawing. I had this in my notes for years to discuss microfluidics. This shows just an artistic rendering of a microfluidic chip. And what we have in here is we have these little sections where we might have different materials that we're mixing together, different types of processing. And then at some point we might want to have like an external laser. And this, what this external laser would do is then do analysis on the material that we just did a test with. So we would take our 30 nanoliters of material. We do our chemical processing to determine some bioactivity or something. And then what we would do is we would interrogate it with this light source or a laser, et cetera. So that brings a lot of times people, they call these things lab on a chip. And then at other times, people would call these chips in a lab, because while we would do the work in this area, and this is where we would run our ambient and do our test, we would often want to have things like lasers or some type of digital detector or some kind of other characterization device that we necessarily don't want to build on board on the chip, because the chip is disposable. So we would try to keep some of the analysis, like lasers and digital cameras and CCD things and memory and computers, we keep that off of the chip because we can reuse that. So basically, this system might be plug and play into something that might look like a desktop. And then that desktop computer kind of thing would have those types of analysis systems in them that would stay all the time. We don't have to replicate them. Again, that would reduce cost. So again, looking at the overview, microfluidic devices handle small amounts of fluid. And this is also good when small amounts are only available, and it's certainly good for conservation of material. Generally, these chips themselves use small amounts of energy. So it's quite common for the emerging technology in microfluidics is actually to probably run the microfluidic system on something like a couple AA batteries, or have it piggyback onto an iPhone or something like that. And then maybe even the iPhone could have some kind of analysis tool on top of that, like a laser, et cetera, and that could do all your work. So going from a macro lab where you'd have a chip involved, maybe we would try to have this chip very small, because a postage stamp and the energy being rather limited to like the power that's available on a cell phone and maybe the computer power that's available on a cell phone. So it's really an efficient way of doing things. These are sealed systems. So if we were doing analysis on some type of, you know, infectious diseases or something like that, it's nice because it's a sealed system. So it reduces the chance of contamination. And it's also the chance that a contaminant in the room or in the environment would throw off your test. So when you have your test being done on board on a microfluidic device, it's sealed and the environment really has little to do with the integrity of the test. The small size leads to mobility. So, hopefully we don't need a lab. And because it's a small size, these reactions can be rather fast. And that's certainly an advantage of these microfluidic devices. So these devices actually are an emerging tool. They're growing quite readily and, they fit the needs of society quite well. So let's again look at microfluidics. Microfluidics is the multidisciplinary field intersecting engineering, physics, chemistry and biochemistry, nanotechnology and biotechnology with practical applications to the design of systems in which small amounts of fluid will be handled. And again, the volumes are like, microliters, nanoliters, etc. They're rather small size. Typically, I would say a microfluidic device, if I had to say what's an average size, I'd say maybe big as a postage stamp. Again, low energy consumption. And the effects are in the micro domain, which are interesting. So what we're going to do is we're going to use a really small device. And this small device is going to be able to do things like really analyze like nanoscale things. So we're going to use a micro scale device and it's going to be able to use that domain to look at things maybe on the nanoscale. So for example, we could have a micro chip or a lab on a chip that's as big as a thumbnail or big as a postage stamp. And what we're going to do is we're going to probably use that to look at something or analyze like a virus. Or maybe we could analyze things like sections of DNA. Or maybe we could analyze DNA itself. So these small tools could be used to look at things that are even smaller. And that's very interesting. And that's really the where I see the most usefulness of these products. So typically the fluids inside these chips are moved, mixed, and separated or otherwise processed. So numerous applications employ passive fluid control techniques like capillary forces. And we're going to look at this later on. This is really important. Fluids in a small domain. So typically in a microfluidic device, you might have a channel that's a hair width or maybe a few hairs. And a hair, I guess a good number to throw out for a hair is 100 microns. So you might have a 100 micron channel. You might have a 300 micron channel. But at that level, when they're so small, a few hairs, large, it's really difficult to push fluids through them. You wouldn't think that, but that's certainly true. So an emerging topic that we're going to talk about later is instead of moving the fluids through force, like a hydraulic force, or use an electrical bias to draw the fluid through these small channels on the order of a few hairs in diameter, what can be replaced is we would use a tool that has some kind of capillary activity, and the tool that we would use is paper. So there's specific papers that will actually draw up fluids, and that wicking of the fluids will get around this activity of the constraints of fluids don't like the flow, and certainly fluids don't like to mix in diameters that are on the order of hairs. So certainly we're going to analyze that or take a look at that in our talk. So in our talk, we're going to start looking at, I guess we would call them conventional microfluidic devices that would generally have a rigid bottom, maybe made out of silicon with a layer of silicon dioxide on top, then perhaps maybe some electrodes. And then the three-dimensional part might be a PDMS layer that has the channels cast into it. Then we would sandwich those together. So the PDMS section would allow fluid flow, and then the planar silicon on the bottom would allow contacts, like electrical contacts and analysis to take place. So we'll look at those first, and then later we'll off of that, once we master that or review that, we'll take a look at devices based on capillary flow, which are paper devices. And they're really popular in the last 15 or so years. So here's the growth of microarrays. Again, the introduction here is why is this important? Well, certainly I think that this stuff is marvelous and science is fantastic, but I imagine most of the students that are taking this course are taking it because the end all result is they want jobs. And certainly this points out, this graph right here points out that you can look at the growth of jobs. The jobs are just going, you know, it's a nice slope on there for jobs. So as time goes on, there's more and more needs adopted with the use of microfluidics. So this means there's a lot more jobs available to people that work in this area. And it's interesting that these jobs that are listed below, like clinical and veterinary diagnostics and point of care diagnostics, and point of care might be something like, say if somebody has a, they potentially have a stroke. When the ambulance shows up, maybe a technician, a medical technician, can draw blood from the patient through a microfluidic device, and it could say if they had a stroke or not. So immediately with standing orders, that first responder could give them some type of shot that would thin their blood or something to counteract the stroke. So that's really good for point of care diagnostics. And again, this might be used maybe by the military, that they can't get a wounded soldier back to a safe area or a hospital. So immediately at that location, they might be able to determine some primary care technique could be used according to what this device would read out. Then there's pharmaceuticals and life science research. So certainly we could study the impact of drugs on cells or cells themselves, analytical devices, and certainly industrial and environmental. So we could use these devices to measure things, take a microfluidic chip on the road, take it out to a stream, and then do some measurement and see if a company is polluting or the you know, cleanliness of a river or a creek or something like that. So that's a really good use of that. And then we could also use these to place drugs inside a patient. So we could use these for drug delivery, like inhalers, microneedles, and all that other stuff. So sometimes you want to be able to maybe measure the patient and then as needed, input some type of drug. So for instance, you could have an insulin pump that would reside on a person, and as they need insulin, it could do that measurement and then push the insulin in the patient as needed. So a smart device. So there's a lot of growth in this area, and I think that this is going to be huge in the future. And again, my personal interest is this area because I see it as a really fruitful for society in general. It's a really nice area, and it's going to be widely adopted in the future, and it's certainly widely adopted now. So another way that you could look at, you know, just as a person, you know, how real is microfluidics, or how can we estimate the impact, or how does this area look to be fruitful? Well, this is the number of papers that are published within the last 20 years. So the interest and the technical value has established this, and it closely, I guess, emulates the need for jobs, or this is an emerging technology that it's put into the commercial market. So now let's switch a bit. So we talked about the importance of microfluidics, or why this presentation is important, or the topic of microfluidics is important. Now we have to look at some things that you might not know about. You know, how is microfluidics different from the macro world that we're all aware of? So some things that we want to take a quick look at to discern these is the physics of microfluidics, and especially we'll look at the flow regimes. So how is flow different than the normal world, you know, in a microfluidic device? How does flow look? And then we'll take a look at one of the things that will tell us about how materials mix, how fluids on a small scale mix. There's a quick equation with only four variables in it, and that's called the Reynolds number. And this will determine if materials will stay separated or they'll mix. And it's kind of unusual, but in our world, I guess things mix a lot. But in a nano world, or the microfluidic world, things tend to stay separated quite a bit. So this Reynolds number will be able to give us some prediction in whether things mix or not. And this Reynolds number has like physical dimensions in it. So for example, we could do things like design our device or areas in our device. We can set the geometry to where they'll mix or not mix. So we need to have this equation or this look at this equation to help us to determine actually how to design microfluidic devices. And then there's the Peclet number. And this number is based on, again, mixing, but this number will tell us how things mix due to diffusion. So generally, diffusion is moderately slow in microfluidics. So this is a secondary impact due to maybe more like a mechanical mixing feature that would be, that will show in a Reynolds number. So we'll take a look at these guys in detail here. So again, the physics of microfluidic devices. The small scale of microfluidics leads to unique conditions and considerations. Factors like surface tension, unique flow characteristics, air traps, and many other factors contribute to the complexity of microfluidics. And sometimes they use air to move things around in microfluidics devices, but often air in a microfluidic device would actually kill the device in some way. Because what we would like to do is move fluids, and fluids are incompressible. So when you push on a fluid, it moves the fluid ahead of it. But if there's air bubbles inside a typical microfluidic device, when you go to push the fluid through, it'll hit that air bubble, and then it'll stall the process from pushing the fluid ahead of it. So air traps and air bubbles inside of microfluidics tend to be bad. There are areas where they would actually manipulate air bubbles and move them around, maybe with ultrasonic, etc., and then they would do work. That's more of the exception. But the general rule of thumb, air traps are not desirable in microfluidic devices. And again, we're going to look at the unique flow characteristics. And I guess unique means, we can probably describe it now, it's hard to flow in microfluidics. So that's what's unique about microfluidic devices. And then we'll look at some selected things like flow and then how we would mix. So electrokinetic devices, if we were to look at microfluidics, and now we're going to propose that we're going to move this and we're going to move it through bias. So certainly we could use some kind of hydrostatic pressure. We could use other things like heat to move fluids. But in this area, we're going to use an electrical bias. And basically, there's two types of flow types when we use electrical bias. There's electroosmosis, and this is driven from the walls. So the walls would actually push the fluid. And maybe for an analogy, I tell the students when I talk about this in class, the analogy is, it kind of looks like a snake when a snake swallows a mouse. So you see the mouse going down the body of the snake. And it's the digestive tract of the snake is actually pushing on a mouse and pushing it down into the mouse. And that reminds me of electroosmosis, where electrophoresis, which is probably another unfamiliar word to you, not a common word, probably a good word for Scrabble or something, so keep that handy. But electrophoresis, what this operates on is if we had a fluid inside a microfluidic device, and we applied a bias, if there were charged particles in there, they would be attracted to the anode or cathode of this bias regime. And what we're going to do is we would take those charged particles, and those particles are going to push against other particles. So basically, it's going to be based on particle flow. So I remember this by, like, a snake is shaped like this, right? Like circular. So osmosis, to me, I kind of remember that as a snake swallowing a mouse. And electrophoresis, because of this P in here, that reminds me of like particle flow. So that's how I tend to remember those names, because again, they're unusual names. People don't walk around saying electroosmosis and electrophoresis in general society. So these are special words. So to remember that vocabulary, I kind of remember that this one, at least to me, would resemble a snake. And then this one is particles, you know, so that's how I remember those. So electroosmosis is sidewall driven, and electrophoresis is particle flow. And again, these are all under the arena that we're talking about using electrical bias to do our work. So this is electroosmosis, and this is the walls. If the walls of the channel have an electrical charge, negative ions in a fluid with an opposite charge will be attracted to the wall. A layer of immobile ions form on the channel surface, while a layer of mobile ions forms at the fluid side. And this forms an electric double layer. So that's going to be like a skid, that layer. So then we can put the center in here and then drive this on top of this bias regime right here. So this is a Debye layer. So when the electrical potential is applied to the channel, the ions in a fluid will be attracted to the opposite pole. The ions will drag along the remaining fluid. So the drive here comes from the wall in this direction, as we can see in these arrows right here. And this is the driver. So this has the energy on the side. Here in the center, there's no energy. So this acts as a resistance, and therefore we form like a wave front that looks like this. So it's collapsed here in the middle, and then this is the leading edges right here, and then this has drag to it. That's important for our analysis later on when we take a look at this, because we're going to actually look at these wave fronts as these wave fronts go into some kind of other area, like if it would hit a channel or if it would hit a particle inside the channel. So we can pretend that these wave fronts, if a wave front looked like this or if a wave front looked like this, two different wave fronts, if they would hit something like a rock. So we could pretend these are waves in an ocean. If these waves in an ocean come up and hit a rock, they're going to break and separate a different way than the waves that were shaped like this and hit the same type of rock. So those waves will break in a different way. So again, I guess this points out to something that I was alluding to before. Fluids don't mix. But when they do mix, I think part of the thing that we're going to have to take a look at or keep in mind is they're going to mix according to, at least on the first iteration, to these wave fronts. And in this presentation, I'm not going to get too deep into the mixing, because actually you would need to have a computer to take a look at that. So to analyze how these things actually mix on the highest order, you need really powerful computer models. And these models typically would be used, or models like that would be typically used to model airplanes, like for Boeing or whatever. So these things that would look at, you know, airflow over wings and how they would design the wings for less drag, et cetera, or something like that. They're very complex programs, and we would need a very similar program to do analysis in microfluidics. But thankfully, there's some back of the envelope equations that we can kind of just give a quick educated guess to how large a microfluidic channel would be. So roughly, I told you before, maybe a microfluidic channel, just to pull a number out of the hat, might be a few hundred microns in diameter, and that's a good one. From that point, what that would allow us to do, at least in nanotechnology and the course that we're studying here in engineering science, we could do things to say like, oh, a few hundred micron channel, I could readily use a Carl Suess MA6 to do my lithography. And it would be very viable to do wet etching instead of plasma-based etching with dimensions that big. So I think those dimensions and these quick equations will allow us to get like a big picture of manufacturing what's necessary. And I think really importantly, to integrate all these ideas together, you know, what's important with microfluidics and how can we just, you know, in a room, you know, over a cup of coffee, somebody came in and proposed some type of idea to use it in one of those many areas that we discussed before, like pharmaceuticals or point of use or what kind of fluids we were doing. You could get a rough estimation of what tools and processes you would need to create a microfluid device. And I think that's very valuable information as an engineer to see the forest for the trees and to actually appreciate, you know, size and scale throughout the whole course of making a microfluidic device. So those quick equations are very, very powerful. But again, to put something into, you know, advanced manufacturing, you probably wouldn't have access to some really powerful computer tools. So, oops, am I going the right way? I'm going the wrong way. So there you go. Electroosmotic flow, it relates greatly to electrokinetic effects, The surface of the fluid develops a charge which influences fluid flow. This creates different layers in a fluid which contain different charges, such as a stern and diffuse layer. So I'm sure you had this in physics, how these layers would build up. And basically what they're going to do is they would make that microfluidic channel look like, I guess, like a greased chute. So these things would set up a layer in here, and then these charges could ride on that layer. So I don't know if I have such a good analogy, but I guess it'd be like a sled ride on ice or something like that, that this would give us that ability to build up this charge, and then this material could flow through there and be pushed through. So to me, it looks like a chute, I guess. I really don't have a good analogy for that one. So the advantage of this type of technique, and again, I think when you look at engineering, you should always look at columns of advantages and disadvantages, and it's never just advantage column. It's always the disadvantage column. And as an engineer, you're a value decision maker. You have to say, do these advantages weigh out the disadvantages, or how could I take these disadvantages and maybe move them over to this column? Or how could I negate some of these disadvantages or minimize these disadvantages? I think that's really important in engineering in general. But as an overview for these electroosmosis, let's take a look at the macro advantages and disadvantages. So there's no moving parts, so that's really good. And something that you wouldn't expect to see, you generally try to minimize moving parts in microfluidics. So we'll keep that as a loose rule. There's no wear because no moving parts, right? There's low diffusion of the laminar flow, keeps that material together, and it's a relatively simple design. One of the disadvantages, you might need high voltages, so this might make it difficult to miniaturize and operate off of batteries. You'd have to step up that voltage. And then you could also have things like non-ideal properties, like when you're doing your process, you can have the process change because as you go throughout the device, you could have chemical absorption to the walls. So basically, the microfluidic device itself should be rather inert so that it doesn't impact the process that you're trying to do. It shouldn't perform non-ideal processes. But what you can do is it can actually lose some of the chemistry in your process due to the walls. So you might change your chemistry as the process goes on. And certainly it's sensitive the fluid and channel chemistry. So you have to have, which might seem trivial, but you really can't change the viscosity of your sample all the time. That sample has to be a certain viscosity and it has to remain that viscosity. So your samples actually have to be, for the most part, probably pre-purified. And that's a big issue. And that's why one of the reasons that they might say that this might be a chip in a lab, because the lab might have to pre-process the material first. So this would help us inside a lab, but we might have to have a lab available to us. But of course, what we're trying to do is, as this technology matures, we're trying to have more and more processes offloaded to the macro lab and onto the chip itself, like purification processes, etc. So we might have a purification microfluidic device, purify the sample, and then take the output of that microfluidic device and then put it into another section or another microfluidic device for further processing. And then a big issue, if we're using this amount of energy, is Joule heating. So if we were, maybe I have a, you know, in the class, I always say things like this. If we were doing analysis on, say, you know, egg whites. So we get a chicken egg white and we apply a lot of bias to it. Then we no longer have egg whites, you know, the clear fluid of an egg. We just made an omelet. So for things like blood might coagulate, proteins will change, etc. So Joule heating might be a big issue depending on what materials we're trying to process, especially for proteins, etc. That might be a major issue and certainly a disadvantage. Like any other test, there's always advantages and disadvantages when you look at any tool. So it's the right tool for the right job, and certainly that's what we're trying to ascertain overall in engineering, make the right decisions. So this is the other section, is electrophoresis. And so what I talked to you about it before, this P in here reminds me of particles, right? So this is the movement of charged particles or molecules that are subjected to an electric field. So cations move toward the cathode and anions move towards the anode. So basically what we're going to do here is we apply some type of bias. And if we applied, say, a plus over here, then these negatives would be driven to that area. And then hopefully, along with these negatively charged particles, if there's neutral particles in here, they're going to drag those along with them. Does that make sense? Hopefully. So what we're doing is we're taking the charged particles, and the charged particles are actually moving the rest of the fluid along. So that's a nice one. So for things that are highly charged, like high ionic concentration fluids, this certainly might come in handy. With fluids that aren't so charged, this probably wouldn't be the way to go. So this is a look at the wavefronts again. I drew them earlier in the presentation, but if we would look at, you know, hydrostatic or like a syringe pump, right here we would drive the fluid in this direction, and naturally there's no resistance at the head here of the wave. And then the walls show resistance. So the wave would be shaped like this. So this is characteristic of pressure driven or pumped fluids. It's also the same wave front as electrophoresis. So this is the parabolic profile of electrophoresis or syringe pump. And again, if we would go around a bend like this, or in this area, go around a bend, certainly this wave is going to change according to the pressure on this wall and on this wall. And it's a function of the original shape of the given wave. So an applied potential, like an electroosmotic flow, would be shaped similar to this, or would come out and then curve in a little bit. It depends on viscosity, bias, etc. But these wave fronts are certainly part of the complex equation of how fluids flow through a microfluidic device. And again, we'll talk about that, but we won't do any great analysis, mostly because we don't have access to a nice computer program. I actually went to companies a few years ago and asked to purchase a program for the students. And it was tens of thousands of dollars a year just to have a key to lease the software. So it was designed not for education, but for industry. So it was really cost prohibitive and certainly complex. So under my budget, I couldn't afford that. But I do have examples that we play in class, like videos, etc. And you can look these things up on YouTube to see how fluids flow in a microfluidic channel. Often they'll have things like they'll model this like as a rainbow kind of thing. And then they put it around this bend and you can see how it corrupts this geometry when it goes out here, or this geometry, how it gets corrupted by going around a bend, which is interesting. So this leads us to these bends. These bends are actually going to be a mixer for us. So that's a look at the future of the notes here. One of the things that we're going to propose is a nice mixer is just some jagged lines. And we'll take a look at some physics of that. So some non-ideal considerations that we certainly want to highlight here is generally, fluids in a micro scale don't want to mix. So the rules is fluids stay separated. And I guess the assumption is, why are we working with microfluidics at all? I mean, just to paint a story. And why we're looking at microfluidics is we probably want to have some mixing. We want to take a reaction. It'd be rather silly just to have two beakers or two samples and set them on the table. Nothing's really going to happen. We want to put them in the microfluidic domain, these two separate beakers or whatever, and see what occurs. We want to have a reaction. We want to, like, you know, stain a sample or prove some chemical function or whatever with this microfluidic device. And we have to have some way of getting these fluids to mix. And so counterintuitive, they don't mix. So we're going to have to take a look at that. And again, I think we beat this a little bit, that these wave fronts, the pressure wave or the wave fronts, affects the mixing too. So we won't take a look at that in detail, but that's certainly too. And then this is what I was saying before. curves in the design, if we have microfluidic channels and they go around a bend, they're going to cause mixing. And they would cause mixing for probably three different reasons. And we'll take a look at those reasons. And then what we can do in the design is we can change the design to actually take advantage of this mixing or non-mixing. So we'll take a look at that here in the notes. So materials may have intrinsic properties that cause mixing or non-mixing. So the intrinsic properties might be that they're highly ionic, or there's a differential between materials, such as like a fixed law thing, a high concentration to a low concentration of materials. If they're mixable, then certainly there would be a gradient of mixing in there dependent on the difference between the materials according to fixed law. So we'll take a look at that also. That would be more of the Peclet number that we're going to take a look at some analysis. And because there's many variables, as I said before, we would actually have to have a computer simulation to work out this the mixing and non-mixing to some higher level. But with some simple equations and some simple analysis, it could give us great insight into the design of the device. So in this presentation, that's what we're going to do. So basically, we're going to do some back-of-the-envelope engineering here in some way to make some, at least be able to make some kind of educated guess at what we would want to design. And then from there, if you were in industry or in this market, well, you probably might want to just make a prototype and see if it works. Or else you could go to things like advanced computer models to try to get a greater depth of understanding. So let's take a look at this mixing and non-mixing. When materials don't mix, they would consider this laminar flow. So that means two fluids would go in a straight line and they don't go together. So an example of this is, like, I live out in the country, so a little story. I have three Labrador retrievers. So they like the water, so they like to swim. So we have some nice trout streams down behind my house, and they go into two streams merged together. So I take the dogs down for a swim, and we'll walk down the creek, you know, for something to do. And the top of the water might be hotter. One section or the left side of the creek will be hot, and the right side will be cool because they actually don't merge together. And that's what you would see is things like that. Like a river will go out into the ocean. It'll be fresh water for quite some distance before there's fixed law and the salty water mixes with the fresh water. So that's what we generally have in microfluidics. So the rule of thumb is these streams like to stay separated. So we can see that in this example where the blue stays on the blue side and the yellow stays on the blue the yellow side. And naturally where they mix, this might be like a chamber in here. And then you would be able to get green down here in the bottom. But for the most part, the rule of thumb is on a micro scale, fluids don't like to mix. So on this small scale, we get laminar flow. So when multiple fluids are introduced, they want to flow in straight lines with little or no mixing. And again, we're referring to things on the scale of like a hair. And typically lab on a chip, that would be a good dimension just to throw out there as a guess at what we would be looking at. And here's another picture, and it just shows that if we had something like alcohol here shown in the red and water, if we would shoot a stream into this water, it would actually stay as alcohol quite a distance before it would start to diffuse. And the diffusion is shown as that gradient of the colors in there. So it actually goes a long distance. And for a device, you know, this is, again, maybe a good scale marker, you know, 10 microns. So this is a tenth of a hair or something like that. So, you know, a channel might be 100 microns or so. So these channels are actually rather small. I expect maybe a channel from here to here maybe to be 100 microns. This scale shows that these channels are about 10 microns or so. But that's interesting how those things would not mix together. And this, again, laminar flow is the norm. And the fluids just don't mix. There's no turbulence. And what we would like to do is, certainly to get mixing, we want to introduce turbulence. Fluids in a non-turbulent system will mix by diffusion only. And that can be slow. It allows you to control the fluids, but it doesn't allow you to actually mix them together. So here's a nice multi-level system that shows the two fluids going in, you know, a yellow and a blue. And as they go through diffusion And going around these bends, they'll tend to mix a little bit more. So this one shows mixing, and a lot of that has to do with those different geometries there. So the fluid mixing, we're dealing with liquids in the amount of nanoliters again, and I pointed this out before in the presentation, but certainly a good thing to know, and probably in your homework, is that, you know, 1/1000th of a droplet, so that's like really nice, gives us 30 nanoliters, and that might be enough fluid to do a reaction. And certainly this is appropriate. I was in a presentation a while ago here at Penn State last semester, and a student was doing his PhD thesis, and he worked in the field of microfluidics, and it's an interest of mine, so that's why I went to see it. And he was saying that they have blood tests, et cetera, but the amount of blood that they need to do conventionally is based on an adult. So they might want to take, I forget the amount, but, you know, a portion of an ounce or something like that out to do a blood test. So typically when they come into a hospital and they draw blood from you, they have this hypodermic needle, and they take out the hypodermic needle, and it might be as big as a Sharpie pen or something like that. And he said, you know, that's fine and well for an adult because they have so many liters of blood in them. But for a baby, they can't, that's tremendous. It'd be like somebody taking, you know, 2 liters out of an adult. So it doesn't scale that way. So for, you know, small animals, you know, if you were to do analysis on something like a mouse, you really can't be taking an ounce of blood out of a mouse to do a blood analysis because a mouse doesn't weigh that much. And the same thing for a human baby or something like that. So this might be a rather dry dimensional story, this 30 nanoliters is 1/1000th of a droplet. But it actually is important, and it can be important in those attributes when, you know, small samples are only available. So if you were studying something like an insect, you really can't get that much fluid out of an insect. So this number becomes important when you're studying things like that. And because the reaction chamber is rather small, the reactions tend to be very fast. So that's certainly an advantage. So we're going to take a look at that or appreciate that as one of the advantages of this area of nanotechnology, microfluidics. And macro mixing methods are difficult to miniaturize on a scale. And again, smaller channels have laminar flows. So maybe where we want to have mixing, we just have bigger channels. So that's a nice statement. If we would take a detailed analysis of that statement, we could turn it around and say smaller channels have laminar flow. Certainly true is if we would go to bigger channels, we would have mixing. And that's certainly true. So generally bends, turns, and increasing channel dimensions increase mixing. So this is what we're going to use for mixing. Maybe if we were just discussing this or talking over a cup of coffee and I said, hey, or I ask the class all the time, how would you do mixing? You know, in microfluidics, what do you think we're going to be talking about, guys and girls? You know, how are we going to approach this problem? And they would suggest something that would look like a mixer that you would mix up like cake mix, you know, like in the kitchen or a dough mixer or something, you know, like a hook or a batter, beater or something like that on a motor and it's churning around. I don't know, I guess similar to a boat prop in the water. And that's not how you do mixing because it's too complicated to do. So we steer away from things like making, you know, things that are rotational in microfluidics because they're really, really difficult to do. I think the science of it is beautiful. The challenge of that is beautiful, but it's really not cost effective. So I think simply if you wanted to create something like a boat motor, you know, a propeller to do mixing, like how you'd mix a milkshake or whatever, or mix pie or cake batter or something like that. Why would you do that when you can just two-dimensionally just put zigzags like this in your channels? That's a heck of a lot easier to make as a mixer than to make a motor and to move it and an impeller and all those other kind of things. That's very cost prohibitive and very challenging. So this as a mixer is a really good idea because it's rather cheap and well understood. So again, let's take a look at the mixing issue. And the mixing issue, we want to define whether fluids on their own based on, you know, simple geometry and simple attributes, limited attributes of liquids. Are these liquids, are they going to tend to mix or not mix? So is their flow going to be laminar or non-laminar? So a quick check number is this Reynolds number. I always call it Reynolds. I think it's Reynolds, though. Reynolds number. Used to determine if a fluid will be laminar or turbulent. It represents a ratio of momentum forces to viscous forces in the fluid. And again, this could be a liquid or a gas. Generally, we're dealing with liquids in microfluidics. It expresses the relationship of fluid density, velocity, channel dimensions, and viscosity coefficient. So it has a limited number of variables. So again, it's a quick check, but it would establish whether you want to have something that would be 50 microns or 500 or 5,000. So it'll give us a good educated guess into our design. So certainly there's other variables that we're not going to consider, but this is a very, you know, viable equation. And certainly this is a old school physics here. This gentleman, did his work in the 1800s. So the Reynolds number here, it's a quick approximation to determine whether the flow is typically fluid or laminar. I mean, laminar or turbulent, I'm sorry. If the fluid is laminar or turbulent. So this is the equation. So D is the pipe diameter right here. V is the fluid velocity. P is the fluid density, or and the mu here is the viscosity. So these numbers are certainly going to increase the number. And as this number increases, it would make this number smaller. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to get this number and we're going to compare this number to geometries, and it would tell us whether the flow is laminar or turbulent within a certain geometry. So again, this is a comparative number. And what it's going to do is give us a best guess at a design. So let's take a look at that. So liquids flow smoothly when they have low Reynolds numbers. So if we don't want to mix, so no mixing is low Reynolds number. If we want to mix, high Reynolds numbers. So microchannels with only tens of microns in dimensions create small Reynolds numbers. And with a small Reynolds number, you'll have linear, turbulent-free streams. So this would be laminar. So generally, as a rule of thumb, we don't want to have that because we probably want to have, at some point, we want to have mixing because our device is going to do something for us in that mixing mode. So mixing could be desirable to have a reaction, and these low Reynolds numbers prevent mixing. But now we can change the Reynolds numbers because certainly if we would go back, let me go back, we can change these. And certainly we can change things like the pipe diameter. So we can simply have a channel like this, which might have a really low Reynolds number. And then we could take it into a chamber like this. And then in this area here, this is going to have a higher Reynolds number because we actually changed this number on top. So we were making this number bigger in this area right here. So we can certainly change that. Certainly, we could also change the fluid velocity. You usually can't change the fluid density and the viscosity because they're given in our experiment. If we were doing analysis on some blood serum or some type of DNA fluid or whatever, these things are certainly probably fixed and we wouldn't change those. But in our design, we can change these items right here. So for a Reynolds number, a rule of thumb is, for really low numbers, laminar flow. For high numbers, turbulent flow. So at small scales, and we said like 100 microns might be a hair or something like that, just to give you a, you know, a reference point. So around a hair, 70 microns, or a really thin hair, fluids will flow in a laminar fashion. And certainly that's a problem. For example, DNA lab on a chip to work, materials might have to be mixed to have a reaction. The small channels will prevent this from happening. So we probably want to go to small channels, maybe to transport fluid like that. Maybe, I don't know. depending on the design. And then to have mixing, we would probably want to go to higher channels. And maybe as some other trivia, I guess the average person sees about 35 micron particles, like dust in the air. So, you know, the vision, and everybody's vision's different, but they generally the rule of thumb is about 30, 35 microns a person can see, you know, dust particles or something about that big. So something like a 3 micron particle, you can't resolve with your eyes. So here's the laminar flow. And again, we're going to compare and contrast this to geometry. So we'll do that. We'll exercise the Reynolds equation. We'll plug and chug and come out with a number. And if we had a number that was like 10 or whatever, we could compare it to these numbers. So the Reynolds number, if the Reynolds number was 10 and it's less than 2100, then certainly it would be laminar. Same with 1500. So if the number is below this number, then it's laminar. If we were in a wide open channel and we calculated with our geometries, et cetera, and our Reynolds number came out to be, you know, 5000 or so, then it would be mixing. That's how we would use this number. And if the number came out to be 50, then it would be laminar, right? So that's how we're going to do it. So we'll look at this, you know, specifically in that geometry, in that portion of the channel, is the fluid mixing or turbulent, or is it non-turbulent? So here's an example using a 50 micron channel. So I guess we could probably guess right away when we said that 70, we're going to have issues. This is less than 70. So I imagine for something this small, we're probably going to have laminar flow, non-mixing. But let's look at the plug and chug right here. So we'll insert that number. We'll insert a common velocity, like a meter a second, you know, density, et cetera. So we put these numbers in, and when you plug and chug, the number comes out to be, it's probably 0.056. And certainly this is much less than 2100. We're going to say through this geometry in our microfluidic device that we have no mixing. And again, we have control over these variables generally. This is the system that we're testing, so they're probably fixed. But we could probably vary these and then be able to modify to get mixing in another portion on our lab on a chip. We could probably change these dimensions so that we do have mixing. So another number that has to do with diffusion is this Peclet number. So we saw in some of those other examples or pictures that I had in the presentation, like we had the yellow ink and the blue ink, and when that actually mixed together through diffusion, we formed like a greenish color. So this determines whether diffusion or convection is the dominant means of mass transport. So diffusion for a number, again, this is a comparison number. If the number is much greater than 1, we'll probably have diffusion. And if the number is less than 1, we're probably going to have to rely on, if we wasn't mixing, we'll have to rely on some kind of macro mixer. Like with the Reynolds equation, we would have to do something like this. We're not going to get diffusion. We would probably have to put jagged lines in there, twists and turns, to be able to do some mixing. So again, here's the simple portion of our equation. We have the velocity of the fluid length. So over a longer length, we're going to have more diffusion. That just makes sense. And then here's the diffusion coefficient. So it's a rather simple equation, which is going to be able to predict whether we have diffusion as a dominant, or how diffusion would impact our mixing compared to other regimes, such as mixing through channels. So when fluids flow laminarly, the primary means of mass transport is diffusion. And this is an extremely slow process. And really the goal of a lot of chips, or just life in general, I guess, is to get things done efficiently and quickly, right? So we might not want to have an extremely slow process. But if we wanted to do something that was time released, maybe we could use this as a tool. Maybe we do want to have the reaction not to happen quickly, but we want the reaction to happen slowly. So maybe a tool is rely on diffusion and make our geometries rather small. And then this would be, you know, the dominant force in that. And we could have a very controlled, slow reaction. So this allows for mixing to occur quickly if we would have a high ionic concentration or diffusion. Making it turbulent, meaning convection is the primary means of mass transport. In the next section, mixing will be accomplished a lot through 90-degree bands. We'll take a look at things like the Dean number. And the Dean number basically shows like an Iran channel that would be going around a bend like this. But if we would take a look at the channel itself, when the fluids go through, they might do something like a curvature like this around these bends. So they fold on top of each other. So that's called the Dean number. So this has to do with the inner and outer wall drag, what kind of resistance to flow that sets up, that would actually set up some kind of flow regime like this. And again, that would be further exasperated by how the wave front went in, you know, the shape of the wave front and how it hits this walls. Then we would have the physics of the Dean number, which would give us this folding action. So that would be very complex. And what would occur at this point is dominant or dependent on those factors. So what we're going to do is we're going to wrap up for today, and we'll look forward to the next presentation here. In that presentation, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a look at operational components. We'll take a look at micro pumps, mixers and stirrers and valves. And then further on, the next section, what we're going to take a look at is applications. So those are things that are coming up, and I actually gave you a preview in these sections. So I hope you're anxious to see those, and we'll talk to you on the next lecture. Take care, guys. Thank you.